BP clearly struggling beyond the spill.
And India goes dark for the second time in 2 days. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
I'm Jeff Horowitz in Los Angeles. It's the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Tuesday, the 31st of July. We're also going to talk with Clyde Drexler, member of the 92 Dream Team. He's been traveling around with the current Dream Team, and he is nothing if not honest in response to questions about money and team building on that squad, so it's good talk. We'll also talk about Peter Jackson splitting The Hobbit into three pieces rather than two. Very controversial.
And there's been a lot of criticism about NBC's handling of the Olympics and these tape delays and all that. We're going to get into that with somebody who's been checking into the dollars and cents of all of it. Coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The British oil giant BP has shocked investors with a sharp fall in profits. The company made $238 million in the last quarter. That compares with a profit of $5.4 billion for the same period last year. The Gulf of Mexico oil spill in 2010 was only partly to blame. From London, here is Stephen Beard.
The spill does continue to take its toll. BP is pumping less oil due to increased rig safety maintenance, and the bill for compensation is rising. The company has set aside a further $850 million for potential claims. But beyond the Gulf, BP is floundering in a bigger sea of troubles. Nick McGregor of brokers Redmayne Bentley says the falling price of oil and gas has hit the value of BP's assets.
On every front, BP has had to turn around and say what we own isn't worth what it used to be.
To take account of its declining assets, BP has lopped $5 billion off its profits. McGregor says the company is becoming vulnerable.
BP in its current state does certainly look as though it could become a target for one of the larger players in the sector.
BP says it's expecting an upturn next year. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The other big news this morning is out of India, where 620 million people lost power this morning. It is just the second major blackout there in just 2 days. The BBC's Rahul Tandon joins us from Calcutta with more on this. Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's not a good evening for thousands and millions of people here in India.
Well, what's the latest there? Is the power coming back on?
Very, very slowly in some parts of India, but we're still talking about hundreds of millions of people who do not have electricity across what is supposed to be one of the world's rising economic superpowers.
Well, yeah, from the outside, this looks like a fast-growing economy whose infrastructure really just can't keep up with the growth. Is that what people are thinking within India?
I think you've hit the nail on the head. We talk a lot about India's emerging middle class. Well, they consume far more electricity than India did do in the past, using air conditioners, with the heat rising as well, with industry also demanding more power. It seems that the networks are just not being able to cope. Yesterday, the northern grid went down. To make matters even worse today, the eastern grid has gone in India as well, adding probably another 100, 150 million people without power. So 50% of the country don't have power. They're trying to get it back. But the question many Indians are asking is, if this is happening today, will it happen tomorrow and the day after as well?
Well, that's exactly the question I had. I mean, what is going to be done to make sure that you don't have another blackout tomorrow?
Investigations have begun, but one has to say, if there's going to be such a drain on the electricity, until India can find ways of increasing its power, there's always going to be the likelihood that this is going to continue. And of course, for outside investors who look at brick economies, maybe they'll be looking at those other letters rather than India now, when they see the chaos that has engulfed this country over the last 48 hours.
Rahul Tandon of the BBC joining us from Calcutta. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, here in this country, we got some news this morning that household income was up 0.5% last month, but consumer spending was down 0.1% when you adjust for inflation. And of course, speaking of inflation, everybody's going to be watching the Fed, which starts a 2-day meeting today, and possibly they're going to be launching some new stimulus. We'll hear about that tomorrow.
Also today, the drug company Pfizer reported higher than expected quarterly earnings. The company says it improved its bottom line by saving money on marketing and research. I find that kind of interesting. The company's planning on spinning off its veterinary unit into a separate company. And just glancing at the markets today, it looks like it was a good day in Asia, sort of a mixed result in Europe. U.S. markets doing just about nothing at this moment as Jeremy and I are speaking to you.
Well, I mentioned the Fed meeting. You know, the U.S. economy has been struggling. That's one reason why they are considering some new additional stimulus from the Fed. Mm-hmm. But there is one area of the economy that seems to be doing okay. Car sales, which there's been some pent-up demand. That could be part of it. But as Tracy Samilton of Michigan Radio reports, some of the reason that car sales are doing so well has to do not with the dealerships, but with the banks.
When banks froze lending in late 2008, it threw a huge monkey wrench into the car selling business. Debbie Crum is financing manager at Snethkamp Chrysler in Redford, Michigan. She says even customers with spotless credit couldn't land a lease or loan. Today, credit has eased to the point that most applications are stamped approved.
Instead of finding a way not to buy the deal, they're finding a way to put a deal together.
And if you do have that spotless credit, the banks and the dealers really want your business. Michelle Krebs is an analyst with Edmunds.com.
0.9, 2.9, they're not uncommon rates.
Even the subprime car loan business is booming, says Krebs, although people with seriously dented credit scores will pay a premium, up to 10% interest for a loan. Dealers say it's not a return to the bad old days of automatic rubber stamping. So sorry, no job, no loan. I'm Tracy Samilton for Marketplace.
Yesterday on the podcast, as part of our coverage of wealth and poverty issues, we talked with President Obama's former top economic advisor, Larry Summers. We talked about inequality, which has become a central issue to the presidential campaign this year. Summers told us the government has a responsibility to make sure that everyone in this country at least has an opportunity to succeed.
The market left to its own devices is not going to help those least fortunate communities provide decent public education. There's much that government needs to do to create more equal opportunity.
Well, for another view, we're joined by Arthur Brooks. He's the president of the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank in Washington. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, yesterday, Larry Summers told us that the discussion really needs to be reframed from inequality of income to inequality of opportunity. What do you think about that?
I agree. And even more than that, we need to largely abandon the whole idea of inequality of economic outcome and talk about mobility in America, because that's the real issue. That's what people care about. People are not worried about inequality at all, as long as they feel there's sufficient opportunity to rise, as long as they think that there's mobility in the economy. And that seems to be what people are starting to doubt quite a bit.
Well, what do you think needs to be done to make sure that people have the equality of opportunity that you would like right now?
Well, the one thing that we don't do is by wasting our time by talking about simply how we can redistribute more money from people at the top simply because they have more money. And that seems to be largely what's going on in America today. We can think of the United States as an apartment building where people at the top floor are doing very well. People in the bottom are seeing flooding. The trouble is that the elevator doesn't work very well, and we have a president and an administration that seems most content to be throwing rocks at the top floor. Well, that doesn't do anything to help the elevator, and that's a metaphor that's rather apt, I think.
The way that you say that, it sounds like you think that there's a possibility that we can reach a point that nobody lives on the bottom floor.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that people who live in the bottom floor should always have access to the ability to rise. And I think that the responsibility of people in positions of political power should be not simply to try to redistribute more from the top, but rather find more ways to help people get out of their economic situation.
Well, do you think then that the government should ensure that everybody has access to going to university?
We spend tons of time talking about college, and college is indeed important. But first, let's talk about primary and secondary education. The truth of the matter is that we're spending multiples per kid in real dollar terms compared to what we were spending decades ago, and arguably getting worse student outcomes. We got to ask ourselves what's going on in this country, primarily because that affects the bottom 20% of the income distribution.
We've talked about the government. What about the free market? What should they be doing to make sure that more people have the ability to succeed in this country?
Well, the free market is exceptionally adroit at doing just that when it goes largely unimpeded. The problem is that today the free market is not allowed to help the poor in lots and lots of ways. If you go back 100 years or even 50 years, you find that the ability of people in the bottom 20% of the income distribution to be entrepreneurs was much higher than it is today. There were fewer regulatory barriers to starting businesses. There were fewer punitive tax barriers to starting businesses. The free market is great at creating opportunity. It's generally speaking the state that gets in the way of the free market such that the poor really can lift themselves up.
So you think that too much regulation is making it impossible for the free market to help the poor in the way that it could?
I think it's hurting a lot, and it's not hurting everybody. I think it's disproportionately hurting the people at the bottom. And that's the real moral problem that we should all have with the system that gets more and more complex.
Arthur Brooks is president of the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, food prices are on the rise, Jeff, and the BBC has played out what exactly that means for us and what we eat 20 years from now.
A lot more ramen noodles, maybe?
Maybe ramen noodles are in the works, but also insects are going to be a big part of our diet.
What I had in mind.
Well, and you know, they're very high in protein and nutrients, so it's not the worst thing in
that,
the world.
Yeah.
But if you want to go vegetarian, maybe I can interest you in some algae.
Maybe not.
Well, scientists say that with 10,000 different types of seaweed in the world, there's probably one that fits your taste, Jeff. So don't dismiss it so easily.
If you call it seaweed, yeah, I've eaten a lot of seaweed in my day. So that works. Seaweed, algae, and insects. Mm. We're going to totally switch gears here for a minute before we head into some great Olympic-related items. Director Peter Jackson has been preparing the world for his two movies based on the book, The Hobbit. And suddenly, Jeremy, like an orc wrestling its way free from the muck of Isengard. Do you get that reference?
No, I didn't.
I do, for better or for worse. A third movie has emerged from somewhere. Jackson says you just can't do it in two. This news has been greeted by mixed emotions, and we're going to work through ours with Scott Beggs. He's managing editor of the blog Film School Rejects. Good to talk with you, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
So, Scott, I'm going to take you through some reasonable scenarios for what might be going on here. I want to hear what you think. First, we'll extend the benefit of the doubt. We'll talk about what you might call the fanboy argument, maybe, which is essentially Peter Jackson's line. He says, the story of The Hobbit is just too rich to do in two movies. What do you think?
I think on the one hand, he really used the right words from our perspective as the filmmakers and as fans. That is the kind of thing that gives an encouragement to people like me, especially who love the universe. On the other hand, it's the kind of thing that shows that he, as a director or as a creative visionary, wants to extend this not for monetary reasons, not for financial reasons, but for the purity of storytelling. And I think that's the kind of thing that the optimist in me really is happy about.
Okay, so you'll take him at his word. But here's a second scenario. Peter Jackson has filmed everything. Maybe he filmed too much, and now that he's back in the editing studio, he's got this painful process and doesn't quite have the stomach to cut it down to two reasonable length movies.
Right, and there's a concern here for some that stretching the story into three films will require too many new concepts being injected into what, frankly, is a literary classic. You know, the idea here is that if it's stretched to three films, this 310-page book, that it can't possibly be faithful to the original work.
And finally, Scott, the totally cynical take, three movies make more money than two. Isn't that basically what's going on here?
There's something to be said. The Lord of the Rings film trilogy took $281 million in investment and turned it into $2.9 billion in the box office alone.
And the third movie was the biggest of all, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. However, the Lord of the Rings trilogy had 1,100 pages of material, The Hobbit, 310. That may not get the same sort of concrete base that the fans gave to the Lord of the Rings trilogy here. And of course, this comes on the heels of splitting books from the Twilight and Harry Potter franchises. And it's a move that's largely seen, and perhaps correctly seen, as being motivated more by profit than by storytelling. And I think that the cynicism there is not unfounded either.
Scott Beggs, managing editor of Film School Rejects. I'm glad for your Hobbit-related insights. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back on.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
So, Jeremy, the U.S. Olympic men's basketball team crushed France in its opening game. Big stunner there. And tonight, it's going to take on that well-known basketball powerhouse, Tunisia. It's been 20 years since the first U.S. dream team changed Olympic competition forever, probably. For the first time in 1992, a rule change allowed NBA pros onto the court rather than the best amateurs, which we were culling from our college teams here in the U.S. Well, Clyde the Glide Drexler was a star guard with the Portland Trail Blazers, and he won a gold medal on that 1992 team. This year, he's been traveling around with the latest incarnation of the Dream Team. Clyde, good to talk with you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
It was a controversial thing at the time in 1992 for professional athletes to make up the U.S. Olympic team because this was nominally an amateur event, right?
Right.
Do you feel like anything was lost in that process, or was it all for the better?
Nothing was lost. I think it was from a competitive standpoint. Every country wants to send their best in every sport. So it was an easy decision, you know, looking back on it. Is one of the most incredible teams ever assembled, and to be a part of that 20 years ago was something very special.
Dwayne Wade, a member of this year's team, has suggested that he ought to be paid for his time. What do you think about that?
You know, NBA players only have a little bit of time off. It's basically a 9-month commitment. And so the 3 months that you do get off, you know, guys really cherish that. But in an Olympic year, it's an honor if you're selected to play for your country. You know, so you do give up your time with your family and friends. So, you know, it wouldn't be a bad, you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion.
And okay, so you don't reject that outright, even as someone who did this on their own dime at the time.
Absolutely.
Over the years, how has the team managed the fact that you're bringing together all of these big egos, people with big money, big endorsement deals, and you're trying to get them to play as a team?
It's easy. Whenever you have guys who are really good at what they do, a lot of times they're good because they're intelligent. One thing the coaching staff has to do is kind of define roles within that team structure. And the players will buy in and do whatever it takes necessary to win because you got to put your egos aside for the betterment of the team.
With all that money in the sport now, how do these guys or do these guys fold gently back into the sort of amateur environment at the Olympic Games?
Well, I don't think the athletes are going to stay in the Olympic Village like most amateurs. Mm-hmm. In 92, we had our own hotel. The same thing will happen this year. It is amateurism at its finest, but at the same time, it's also representing your country.
But part of what I hear you saying is, you know, they're not going to be slumming it in the cafeteria with the cross-country stars.
You know, a lot of those guys are making, not all, a lot of them, some of them, are making $20, $25 million a year. I don't think they'd be slumming it in anybody's cafeteria anytime soon.
Clyde Drexler, member of the 92 Dream Team NBA star. It's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Continued success to you as well.
And our online folks have whipped up a nifty little infographic comparing the Dream Team player salaries, all of them, of 20 years ago and the complete roster today. And Jeremy, today's top player, Kobe Bryant, he makes 5 times as much as David Robinson did. He was the highest paid in 92. You can check that out at marketplace.org.
Well, when it comes to going for the gold in London, shiny medals aren't the only reward. Athletes' Olympic success can lead to big money endorsements. The high-performance competition can also, it seems, be a gateway to Wall Street. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Some athletes could be hearing something else as the Olympic music plays. Their performance could help ring in a job on Wall Street, and it's no coincidence you'll find a number of former Olympians in that rough-and-tumble world.
The amount of discipline it takes to become an Olympic-level athlete means that you know what it takes to be successful.
Former Harvard University athlete Ron Mitchell is the founder of the Alumni Athlete Network, which has placed hundreds of young athletes at major Wall Street firms. He says just like the Olympics, winning on Wall Street can happen in fractions of a second.
Athletes like that type of stimuli and often need that type of stimuli to excel.
Former Olympians in the financial world include rowers, swimmers, and wrestlers. American water polo defender Peter Hudnut is already planning to pursue a career at Goldman Sachs after the London Games, and Mitchell says he'll be surprised if Hudnut's the only one making that move.
I would expect a lot of the firms will come calling for this group.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We are now several days into the 2012 Olympic Games, and one controversy has emerged above all others. Not a doping scandal, not a fight between two opposing nations' teams. It's the coverage of the Games itself, all over Twitter especially, but really everywhere. People have been complaining about NBC's handling of the Games.
Here to talk with us about it in today's Midday Extra is Matt Wells, who is the networks editor at The Guardian. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how are you doing?
Doing well. So what exactly is NBC doing wrong here?
Well, it's a number of things. It's the fact that they are trying to shepherd everybody into the primetime broadcast later in the evening on NBC, which is, of course, hours after the actual real events have all taken place in London. And because of the spread of social media, because of the fact that everyone knows what's going on, it's very hard to avoid the big events that have been happening during the day. Mm-hmm. It's like NBC's pretending that this isn't happening, that there is a whole thing that's going on over in another part of the world that isn't happening. You try to avoid it, and they try to pretend it doesn't happen, and they want you to watch it in the evening. But of course, that's not working.
The people who are complaining, I think there seems to be this overtone that NBC is just they're insane. They've been completely stupid about how they've gone about this. But of course, they are not stupid. They are a very experienced broadcast company owned by Comcast, which knows how to make a buck. So when we look at the bottom line and we look at ratings, how are things there?
Well, yes, NBC are not stupid people at all. They know that the most advertising dollars are to be made in prime time. And if they were to show all the events during the day as they happen, they think that the audience for the primetime shows would go down and they would be able to make less money. In fact, they're making about $1 billion of ad sales money already in their primetime shows. They're only making $60 million from digital. They are streaming events live on digital, of course. And they've had record viewing figures. 40 million people across the United States watched the opening ceremonies. There have been record audiences of similar levels for all the primetime shows over the weekend and into this week. So it does seem that their strategy is working. But what some media critics are saying is they wouldn't necessarily diminish their primetime audience or indeed their advertising dollars if they were just to acknowledge that there are these events taking place, that there are big medal events happening during the day, and showed them during the day too. I think they've failed to realize that we are living in a connected world where it is just impossible to avoid news of what has happened during the day. And personally, I am perfectly capable of understanding that Michael Phelps won or didn't win his gold medal event, and then still enjoy the drama of it in prime time too. And I think that's where NBC is going wrong.
But isn't that exactly what they're doing? I mean, they're not pretending anything. They're just running the event later on a delay, and you could find out that he won and then go watch it and enjoy the race.
Well, in fact, they do pretend that things didn't happen because, there's this curious thing in the primetime show that they try not to give you any spoilers. But then in last night's primetime NBC show, the presenters didn't say, tried very hard not to say what the result of Missy Franklin's swim race was, but then they ran a promo for the Today Show, which gave the result away. So I think they're struggling within the divisions to decide which way they're playing it. Are they pretending that it didn't happen during the day, or are they not?
And it wasn't just any commercial break. It was the commercial break right before the race.
You got
right?
It was seconds before they showed the race. So I think there are even internal troubles within NBC. There are internal kind of debates within NBC about confusion there about what they should be doing.
Do you think that they are maybe just going to keep taking the heat and collecting the money in prime time, or would you foresee some change in course here?
I think they are set on this course. This is an enormous operation. They have 2,700 staff. They are broadcasting more than 5,000 hours of programming online and in primetime and during the day on CNBC and NBC Sports. So this is a massive juggernaut, and I do not think that they can make huge changes right now. I think they can tweak it. The NBC News division has already started being a bit more careful about how they present results on the NBC Nightly News. Brian Williams is delivering spoiler alerts in the headlines now. So they're being a bit more careful about it. They can tweak it here and there, but the principal way of delivering this presentation isn't going to change, I think. It's just too late for that.
Matt Wells of The Guardian, thank you so much for very interesting stuff.
Pleasure. Great talking to you.
Well, if you ever win an Olympic medal, Jeff, even a bronze one, I have one request for you.
Okay.
Do not take it into the shower with you. That is...
I can promise you that, I suppose.
Just not
a
good
idea.
It's a
small thing to ask.
A Brazilian athlete did that, and he dropped it, dented it, and then broke the string so he can't wear it around his neck anymore. He asked the Olympic Committee for a new one, and they reportedly are going to give him one. And I just hope that they also send him a rubber ducky so that he doesn't have to take his medal with him into the shower anymore.
You need something to keep you company in the shower.
Exactly.
I can understand that. Well, finally, we talked with Matt Wells from The Guardian a little while ago, and he brought up this thing that happened last night on NBC where they basically, on the commercials immediately preceding a race, gave away the outcome to the race and spoiled it for anybody who wanted to keep themselves pure for the watching. Well, thinking about that in the wee hours of this morning when your brain's just doing nutty things inspired me to do a little twist on a classic poem, and I have that for you now.
All right.
'Twas 5 minutes to race time, and all through my place had the tools of technology frozen in place. The iPhone was nestled quite snug in its cradle, notifications on silent, the ringer disabled. I'd logged out of Facebook, put Twitter away, I'd sworn off of email, if just for one day. Done all that I could not to hear, read, or see, and had just settled down to turn on the TV. Well, there's no way I could have done anything more. I pulled down the curtains and bolted the door. The excitement had built, tension hardly diminished, even though in the real world the race was long finished. When, how were my news virgin eyes so abused, the Today Show promoting the next morning's news, athlete's family so merry, the hugging, the kiss, her gold medal mocking my ignorant bliss. I spoke not a word, but fell back in my chair, not believing that promo had actually been there, and I swear just a flicker had crossed my TV of a smug peacock thumbing its nose right at me. And then to the race, the programming resumed, but with all the electricity sucked from my room, as I heard them exclaim before I turned off the set, it is these kinds of moments you'll never forget. I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.